You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast. 20 Minutes with Tim Pratt. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robertson.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I have the great honor to share the microphone with some awesome, awesome people. And this guy today is fucking amazing.
This guy today. Let me tell you about this guy.
Tell me, Brian, all about this guy.
I got so much to tell you about this guy. This guy, you know, Brian, in this world that we live in, there are people. Rare individuals, but there are people who can actually see the cracks between our reality and actually peer through them into the infinite worlds beyond. Now, some people are content to just look, but not our guest host. Oh no, he has made a career of taking a pry bar to these cracks and opening them wide and allowing the magic to flow through so we can all experience it. He grew up in North Carolina and discovered his amazing powers when, at the age of 14, he found the very first volume of the year's best fantasy. And in the shadow of Jonathan Carroll and Charles DeLint, he discovered his uncanny gifts and began tracing the fractures of our fragile world. His mystical training began with a B.A. in English from Appalachian State University and then continued in a writing workshop with none other than Orson Scott Card, and then going on to the esteemed Clarion East Writers' Workshop. Now, he had been striking sparks in the world several times with several tales and poems, but it was in 2002 when his story Little Gods was nominated for the Nebula Award for Best Short Story that the world began to shift, becoming a much cooler place as more people began to experience the wonders of his perspectives. In 2004, he was a finalist for the Campbell Award for Best New Writer. His story, Heart and Boot, was reprinted in Best American Short Stories 2005. Now, I have this highlighted, Brian, in my listing here, because that's not Best American Fantasy Stories or Best American Horror Stories. No, that's Best American Short Stories, period, baby.
Creme de la creme.
Exactly. This is our guest host is now a part of the American literary history, which is badass. His first novel, The Strange Adventures of Ranger Girl, published in 2005, was nominated for the Mythopoeic Award, won the Romantic Times Critic Choice Award for Best Modern Fantasy, and achieved the acclaimed and much esteemed Emperor Norton Award. In 2006, his Impossible Dreams won the Hugo Award in the Best Short Story category. In 2007, he literally began to carve out his own separate realities in earnest, publishing a series of contemporary fantasy novels featuring the kick-ass sorcerer Marla Mason. Since then, novels like Blood Engines, Poison Sleep, Dead Rain, Spell Games, Bone Shop, and Broken Mirrors have been serialized on the internet at, get your pencils ready, kids, marlamason.net. Definitely make that scene. In 2009, he donated his archive to the Department of Rare Books and Special Collections at Northern Illinois University. Brian, who does that? That's amazing.
People like Tim.
Yes, people like Tim. Now, not only has his work appeared in such luminary publications as Asimov Science Fiction and Realms of Fantasy, and on the Escape Artist podcast, Escape Pod, Podcastle, and Pseudopod, achieving the much-coveted trifecta of that group of podcasts. Yes, awesome.
And just to jump in real fast, the last one that was on, they actually named him the most reappearing author that they've had.
Oh, now that's awesome. There should be like a certificate or something for that. That's badass.
I agree. Yeah.
Not only this, though, but he's also written some very cool RPG tie-in novels. Venom in Her Veins was written for the Forgotten Realms role-playing environment, and City of the Fallen Sky was written for the Pathfinder series, which is just, again, that game connection. We love that stuff.
Absolutely.
His most recent rift in our reality is a very cool steampunk novel titled The Constantine Affliction, and is published under the pseudonym T. Aaron Payton. So friends, please welcome to the big chair at the round table, all the way from Berkeley, California, where he lives with his family and works as senior editor at Locus Magazine, ladies and gentlemen, Tim Pratt. Tim, dude, I cannot thank you enough for taking time out of what must be a monstrous schedule as parent, author, and walker between the worlds to make time for us. We really appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. Brian, we need to get into this like right now because
we got stuff
to ask. I'm gonna set the timer right here for 20 minutes. We will, of course, ignore it. But, you know, hey, sometimes you got to frame these things up. Tim, let me start off with sort of a general question. What is your biggest challenge creatively as a writer? What are you confronted with time and again as you sit down to write? And how do you overcome that? How do you get past that obstacle and continue to make the awesome stuff that you make?
Yeah, I'd love to give you a big philosophical, artistic answer, but the real thing that I run up against most often is time.
Bastard time.
Yeah, it's a pain in my ass. I have always been one of those compulsive writers, you know, one of those people who finds writing fun. In fact, writers who say that writing is incredibly painful for them, I feel great sympathy, and I'm a bit baffled because
they're doing it wrong.
Well, you know, there are some people who create great work, and they really have to suffer to do it, and I admire their willingness to suffer. I wouldn't suffer. If I hated it, I'd stop. But I really enjoy it. And sort of my preferred method for how to write in a perfect world, if it were entirely up to me, what I used to do when I was younger, I would binge write. You know, I would take 6 hours or even 8 hours and I would just sit at the keyboard, stopping only to pee and get more beef jerky and just, you know, allow myself to disappear into flow, you know, to absolutely immerse myself in the fictional world and just write and just pour it out and just let great ugly torrents of hideous first draft appear on the page on the screen. And then a few years ago, my son was born, and he's almost five now. He's actually going to public school here next week.
Wednesday. Dude. Yeah. Are you ready for that? Are you prepped for that?
It's sad. It's kind of a bummer. On the other hand, it's going to give me more time to write because years ago, you know, I have a day job. I work at Locus Magazine. Years ago, I started taking a day off every week so that I could have time to work on writing. So I would work 4 days in the office and then have a free day. Well, after my kid was born, I thought, you know, it might be nice as a parent to spend time with your small child while you can.
Why not?
And, you know, you only have so many years. So that became our day. And, you know, I would write a little bit, you know, if he would fall asleep in the stroller or whatever, I would sit on a park bench and desperately scribble. But mostly I lost the writing. But now that he's going to school, I'll get that day back. And I might actually be able to binge again like I used to.
Ooh.
In the meantime, in the past 5 years, I haven't had that time. I haven't been able to write that way. So I've had to completely alter the way that I approach writing. I couldn't just sit down with only the vaguest sense of what I was going to put on the page and start typing and see where it takes me because I don't have time. I would have sometimes only 15 minutes, you know, especially when he was really young. Time is almost impossible with little kids.
So sleep, I'm told.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, for the first several months, yeah, night is day and there is no day or night. It's just 3 hours of consciousness followed by broken snatches of sleep. I had deadlines and stuff. I wasn't able to stop writing for the first year of his life. I had to keep working. So what I had to do was just reinvent my entire approach and just figure out how to write in those shorter intervals. Well, time remains the biggest difficulty, I have to say. I have more ideas than I can possibly write. You
know, and what a horrible place that is for a writer to be.
You know, ideas are easy. It's execution that's hard. That's what takes the time.
Yeah. So, Tim.
Yeah.
I want to kind of move into some of the things that you do, and not just do, but you do them exceptionally well. And a lot of our writers, you know, are trying to do similar things, and so it's nice to have an expert on the show. In your Marla Mason series, first of all, your protagonist is a strong-willed, confident firecracker of a woman. You also have several women protagonists in your short stories, and we're seeing more and more often now men writing women and women writing men. So for our writers that are trying this out, what considerations do you think they need to really sit down and hammer out before attempting to write in a voice that belongs to the opposite sex?
The key thing you have to remember, and it's crucial, is that they're actually people.
Right.
That's mainly it. They kind of want the same things that, even as a guy, you know, they're probably interested in the same things that you are as a guy. Probably maybe not as many depraved sexual fantasies every few seconds. I mean, again, and I've known some for whom that's definitely not true, who are the equal of any man. But the important thing, you know, they want the same things. They want to succeed in their chosen field. You know, they want to achieve their artistic endeavors. They want to take care of their family. You know, and right. In some ways, it's really interesting to write women, especially if you're writing something about, you know, magic or some, you know, system where there's a hierarchical kind of thing going on. I'm sort of going to jump ahead a little in terms of craft stuff. One of the things I try to figure out write is how can I make life more difficult for my characters? You know, and in a given book or story, which kind of character is going to have the hardest time? Because that struggle is one of the things that's interesting in fiction. And, you know, it really blows, but things are a lot harder for women in our culture. And our culture is one of the better ones in terms of sexual equality, gender equality. So trying to write about a strong woman brings up a whole set of challenges. You know, they're going to get more crap than a strong guy is. So in terms of narrative opportunity, it actually is not a bad thing. It helps because it gives them more stuff that they have to overcome. And it actually allows you to interrogate some of that stuff, some of the gender and sexual inequality issues, which are something that I worry about. The main reason that I write so many women, it wasn't like a conscious thing I was doing. In my first short story collection, I dedicated to some of my female relatives because I was raised by women. You know, I grew up in a family where, you know, men tended to be sort of marginal on the sidelines, or they were alcoholic, or they knocked women up and then they left. You know, there's a lot of that in, you know, and there are great men in my family too. I don't want to make it sound like they're all cads. You know, I have some wonderful uncles and stuff, but there were a lot of examples, especially first 5 or 6 years of my life, of men being absent or being kind of shitty guys. So I was raised by my mom, who was a single mom for the first few years of my life. I was raised by my great-grandmother, who was an incredibly strong, tough matriarch. I was raised by, you know, one of my great aunts did a lot of stuff. My grandmother did a lot of stuff. So it was never a question to me that women would be strong and be capable of dealing with anything, you know?
Sure.
Just not take shit. It was never a realization I had to come to. It was actually harder for me to start writing strong men who were not strong just in that they were assholes who made trouble for everybody. You know, it's a kind of strength. It's not a very sympathetic character.
But is there a difference between, I mean, Tim, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. They're fundamentally different people. How is there a gender consideration when you go in there? It's like, okay, I'm writing a woman now, therefore I can't do this or I shouldn't do that. Is there a guideline for those of us that are kind of hunting in the weeds here?
You know, make them a person, make them a well-rounded, full individual with their own strengths and weaknesses, and absolutely be aware of the fact that if it is a female in, you know, I tend to write a lot of stuff in contemporary society, be aware of the challenges that they're going to face in contemporary society, that they're going to have to deal with sexism, that they're going to have to deal with people thinking that they're just not able to do things, that they're going to have to be better than the best guy in order to get any respect in their field. Certainly be aware of that stuff, but it's not as if I sit down and think, well, I'm going to write a woman and women have these stereotypical qualities.
I wasn't going there, but okay.
Well, but at the same time, I think that's something that a lot of new writers struggle with.
Sure.
You know, is that idea that if I'm going to write a woman, I have to sit down and I have to start thinking like a woman. And I think that what you just said about, no, you have to start thinking like a person is very important.
Right. And identifying those unique challenges. You know, in contemporary society, we can see it all around us. Just open a newspaper or fire up a Twitter feed. But in a fantasy setting, you know, considering from that perspective, you know, what are the challenges of for each gender as you go through? That can only help expand and flesh out the substance and authenticity of the characters that you write in that setting.
Important to remember that being a woman is not a quirk. It's not like a...
Yes, that's very important.
Yes. For example, you might see there'd be a party of misfits, right? There's the guy who has, you know, telepathy, and there's the guy who has telekinesis, and there's the guy who is really good at doing mental calculations, and there's a girl.
No, this is what not to do.
And that's another really great point, because one of the things that we run up against is, and this is in a few of our recent episodes, you know, people who they've written or they have an idea for a story, and then inevitably it gets brought up that, well, you don't have any women, or you don't have a strong woman, or you don't have this. And is it necessarily something that the writer then needs to go back and infuse that or bring that in, or is it just that that particular story doesn't call for it?
Well, first, let me disclaim, I do not want to speak for women or how to write women as a guy.
Of course not.
Explaining this is the way that female characters are done. But I have written boy stories. You know, I've written stories that were about men and about relationships with men that weren't hugely about women, and that's fine. I think that it's something that you don't need to worry so much about on the individual story level, but you need to worry about it in the aggregate. If you're writing a bunch of stuff and you never have any women, or the women you do only red-haired assassins, you know, piercing green eyes and fall in love with your protagonist, if that's their only function, if you're starting to see that kind of thing over and over, then yeah, you maybe need to step back and think, wait, do I know any women in my life? You know, and again, I'm not going to say every story must have a strong woman and must have women who pass the Bechdel test, because there are some stories that don't. You know, there are stories where it's about one guy alone in a moon base going crazy.
Right. Strong woman.
Sure. More necessary to have any dead wife necessarily, right? But again, I think across the aggregate, if you're thinking about your whole career, every story you write, obviously fantasy is not a perfect mirror of the world by intentionally. It's supposed to have magical, weird stuff. But if your magical, weird world doesn't even have as many opportunities for women as the real world does, maybe you're doing something wrong. Maybe you want to rethink your priorities and rethink your approach.
Sure.
You
know,
remember, all kinds of world, and you have access to all those people. Why would you write stories about the same kind of people over and over and over? Bring in different kinds of people. Look around. See things and draw inspiration. So, yeah.
Stretch yourself as a writer. Absolutely.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Tim Pratt after this brief promotional break.
The fire has failed to light. The sun...
If the sun is dead, they will need the angel's word more than ever.
So... this world is in limbo, is it?
It is possible.
Look, River, I came to warn you. You're in danger. Volpez thinks you're becoming emotion-capable. They're watching you.
Forgive me, but are any of those artificial people about?
Ever wonder what the Hapax actually was? What exactly did Ael Sage create? Everything?
I don't know.
The avatars of Ael shall war amongst themselves, and each shall seek the last seer among us before the dawning of the seventh day. The angel has already sought me.
You can't believe it's actually the end days.
Oh, really?
Hapax, a podcast novel by K.T. Briskey. Find out more by visiting www.ktbriskey.com. That's www.ktbryski.com.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Tim Pratt.
Tim, I wanted to ask you, one of many of the stories that you have written that have caught my attention time and again are the magic shop stories, the person who is wandering around in the world and suddenly stumbles into a place that is not of this world, or is existing in multiple worlds, or has access to a different reality. And those stories, I think, appeal to a broad range. Obviously, you enjoy them as an author, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about what it is about those types of stories that draw you time and again.
Well, specifically Little Magic Shop stories, I blame that entirely on working in an antique store for a couple years. Just encountering all these little things, you know, stuff from 100 or 200 or 400, whatever years ago, they're artifacts of a different time and a different place. They are literally stuff from an alternate universe. It's a place nobody alive has ever been, right? We know about it only secondhand, only through reports, and only through interpreting these artifacts that we have. So I always found that really fascinating to sort of look at the stuff. I spent a couple years working in an antique store, and that's one reason Little Magic Shops have been a setting for me, because every object is a story. You know, it was probably precious to someone at some point, and now they're dead, and all that's left is this thing. One of the psychic powers that I like to play with sometimes is psychometry, the idea that you can pick up an object and feel its past, you know, or see visions or smell things or hear things of where it was. Sort of time travel through associational objects is just something that I think is cool, because essentially I would do that. I'd pick stuff up and speculate about it, fantasize about what it might have been. In a larger sense, the dislocation thing, seeing different kinds of worlds, for me, there are two large strains of fantasy that I like to play with. There's immersive fantasy and there's intrusive fantasy. So in immersive fantasy, like my Marla Mason series is about sorcerers. It's about people who use magic. It's largely set in a society of people who know about magic, right? And there are mysteries and things that surprise them and things they discover. But basically, it doesn't shock them that, oh gosh, there are monsters in the world or whatever. There are shapeshifters. There are gods of death. They expect all that stuff. The other strain is intrusive fantasy, which is something that Charles DeLint does extremely well. Jonathan Carroll does it really well. People who are influences of mine. Stephen King does it too. He tends to make it more horrific. It's where your ordinary life and bopping along and everything's fine, and then you encounter something inexplicable that forces you to reconsider everything about your life. That's the intrusive fantasy. You know, magic comes in and disrupts your life. So when I have people wander into these other places, I mean, I don't think every fantasy story has to be a metaphor or have, you know, whatever, but one of the things fantasy does well is act as a metaphor, is give you some externalized way to understand an internal state. I mean, all of us have encountered something in our lives that have made us reconsider everything that came before, have made us look at our prejudices in a new light, made us think maybe I've been going about things the wrong way, or these unconsidered assumptions that I've always had might not be true. So you can dramatize that kind of emotional awakening in a fantasy story very well by having somebody walk along and have something magical jump right in their face. Not to keep talking endlessly, but the other thing, one reason I write about alternate realities a lot and people who discover parallel universes is my abiding obsession as a writer and as a human being is those linchpin moments in your life when everything changes. They're these unexpected stuff. I don't mean when you apply to grad school and then you go to grad school. I mean when you go to a party and meet the woman you end up marrying, you know?
Right.
If you'd gone to the bathroom at the wrong time, you wouldn't have met them. You know, when you go out and cross the street and get hit by a car and break your leg and spend weeks in the hospital and lose the job that you had, you know, when these unexpected things that utterly change your life. And, you know, in science fiction and fantasy, we can play with the notion of parallel universes and mini worlds theory and the idea that everything that can possibly happen does happen somewhere. So I've written a lot of stuff about gods of crossroads and about piercing the veil to parallel universes and about, you know, multiple identities existing within a single person. Something I come back to again and again is the fact that there are these little unexpected moments that change everything forever after and set you on a new path. Those are awesome in fiction. Those are so fun to dramatize. And I can look back in my life and see so many of them for myself, so many tiny chance things that completely altered my trajectory. And they build on each other. So that's something that fascinates me as a person. So it's really fun to play with characters. And the great thing about fiction is you can explore what would have happened if this had happened, if you had gone this way. You can look at those change moments, and you can do it in really cool ways. With
any way you want. Absolutely.
Right, right. And that's one thing that I've found in your stories that I think is it makes it so much fun for me as a reader to read, is that you don't hold back. If there's something that you want to do, you just do it. And you obviously are having fun doing it. And that kind of brings in the Constantine affliction, where there's this gender switching disease. And I think on your website, you kind of talked about how there were some agents or some publishers who just were like, I don't want to touch this because it's just too weird for me, you know? Yeah. And so is there ever a time that you have an idea for a character and just think to yourself, okay, now this is totally ridiculous and no one will ever go for this, and ever end up holding yourself back?
No, I generally don't hold myself back. I have to say, I've never really dinged for being too damn weird, honestly. And, you know, Right. And on the continuum of stuff that I tend to write stuff that, it might have outlandish premises and it might have crazy stuff happening, but it tends to be fairly well-grounded psychologically. My characters, sure. I try to write well-rounded people. So for me, what's interesting is how a well-rounded person runs up against these outlandish things. That said, I'm not going to say there's never been any resistance. I just never paid any attention to it. My first editor was Juliet Ullman at Bantam Spectra. She's a fabulous editor. She's edited tons of great writers. And she did my first novel and the first four books in my Marla Mason series before I had to go indie and start self-publishing. But Juliet's actually like a hard science fiction fan. She really likes literary stuff, but she's like a science fiction person. And she would always be sort of baffled when we would sit down and talk and I would tell her about my books and I'd say, well, and then it's going to be supernatural cowboys. And she would kind of look at me like I was crazy. And then when I would give it to her, she would say, well, okay, I hate fucking books about magical doors, but you made it work. You know? I wonder about my novel Briar Patch that came out last fall, and one of the central things in Briar Patch is there's sort of a strange, dark, inscrutable god that appears in the form of a large Chrysler car, and I was like, and it's got a magical car that drives through realities, and she just looked at me like I was crazy, and I was like, no, trust me, I can actually do it. And I think get away with the outlandish stuff if you ground it psychologically and ground the way people react to it in a way that's understandable and comprehensible. So you can always, you know, it's the old adage about it's okay to have your head in the clouds as long as your feet are on the ground, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's awesome. I think that's the key right there is that, you know, anybody that plays in this playground of fantasy or even science fiction, I mean, you can come up with some really bizarre stuff. And you just made the comment of, you know, as long as you ground it psychologically, people can embrace that. How do you do that? How do you take the notion of a gender switching virus or a Cadillac that rides through realities and do, and I guess I'm asking you, how do you do what you do, Tim? But is there a perception or a way that you approach a concept that you can articulate as to how you take these outlandish concepts and then ground them in that way that makes them approachable and relevant within the story?
You know, have details that ring true. My experience is always that you can get away with a big outlandish thing as long as you don't try to do little outlandish things. You know, you can have a giant stomping around and destroying the countryside. Don't have him fly. You know, like when he takes a step, it puts a big hole in the ground. It shakes the earth. You know, try and take your outlandish thing and treat it somewhat seriously. One of my teachers at Clarion was Tim Powers, who's a fabulous writer. I actually dedicated the Constantine Affliction to him. He writes fantasy beautifully, but he really thinks about it. Like, he told us at Clarion, he never really writes about dragons. He said, if I ever wrote about a dragon, I'd have to sit down and figure out how the hell it flies, you know, how its musculature works, how much its chest would have to stick out to have enough length for the wing muscles to actually expand as much as they would need to, you know, and actually ground that stuff realistically. You can have, and it's not necessarily you must work out the physics. I actually kind of like the numinous in fantasy. I like fantasy where it's not entirely inexplicable. It has maybe a kind of dream logic, but have the characters react to it in a way that makes sense. Again, this is my kind of stuff. There are plenty of people who write surrealism and bizarro and things where stuff goes completely bizarre. You know, Ray Vukovic is a great short story writer. He often writes short stories where the characters initially seem sort of normal, and then it just takes a left turn into surreality, which is great. It's not really what I do. What I'm more interested in is taking people who are much like people I know and then throwing things at them. And the key is to have somebody whose personality is not such that they're going to immediately have a mental breakdown as soon as they encounter something unreal.
Yes, good call. Sure. Good short story otherwise. Very short story.
Right.
That's awesome. Thank you. That clarifies things nicely for me. Brian, you did something very cool with your high school creative writing class.
Okay, so Tim, this is a little bit of a departure from what we normally do, but I'm going to give you kind of a lightning round. I took my kids, I teach high school creative writing, and we listened to The Secret Beach together, and then I told them that you would be on the show, and that they had an opportunity if they wanted to ask you a question. And so the first one that I'm going to ask you, I'm not really expecting an answer to. It just made me laugh out loud when I read it, so... In The Secret Beach, your main character at the very beginning is talking about running down to the to Trader Joe's to get the rest of what he needs to mix a drink. And so the question was, by the way you describe the whiskey, do you drink while you write?
Anytime I'm not writing, I drink. I generally don't drink much when I write, no.
There you go. Excellent answer.
Good answer.
All right, next one. What do you value more, knowledge or imagination, and why?
Knowledge feeds imagination, so they're both really important. You don't get ideas unless you feed your brain with other ideas. Quite often, the cool thing you come up with in a story is about recombining stuff that you've encountered in your life. So, both.
Excellent.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. What do you do when you have too many ways to end a story?
Well, what a sensible person would do is pick the one that has the most fascinating impact and will leave the reader stunned and shocked. Usually what I do is go for the weird... anticlimactic.
Why is that? Why would you do that?
It's traditional narrative stuff sometimes. You know, my first novel, Blood Engines, sort of is building to this epic confrontation between my main character and a god that's just been resurrected, and she sits out the last fight on a picnic blanket eating an apple while this guy to kill the god goes and kills the god. And I don't know, it just delights me because it's unexpected. It's not, you know, you expect it to end in a big fight, but to me that's kind of boring. I've seen the big fight a million times. If I watch a superhero movie, then I start fast forwarding through the fight scenes because, well, you know, what I find interesting is like how they have trouble opening pickle jars without destroying the jar, or, you know, how they have difficulty kissing their girlfriend without their ice breath freezing her, whatever. That's the stuff I find interesting.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You're absolutely a subversive right. writer.
Two more, very
yeah,
quick.
Go for
One
it.
Is, what do you do before writing to get into the zone?
Absolutely nothing. I don't have any rituals, because if I had rituals, I would never get anything done. Because too often, you know, my kid is on the merry-go-round, so I have a minute to scribble in a notebook while he goes around five times. So I have zero rituals.
Excellent. And then the last one, and this is one that we should probably be asking of everyone, but as a career writer, do you have any advice for starting writers?
Spend time polishing that one story to try and get it perfect. Get it as good as you can, obviously, and then send it off and then write the next story. I know a lot of people who just endlessly rework a couple things, and it's fine, but I think you actually learn more if you set yourself a new challenge. Get it as good as you can, send it out, start the next story. Give yourself a lot of opportunities to win, a lot of opportunities to hit.
Excellent. And then when if you get a rejection, I don't know if you ever have, but if you get a rejection, do you ever feel compelled to go back and do a rewrite?
If one editor rejects it, absolutely not. If 10 editors reject it, probably not. If every editor, including editors who I know are simpatico with my stuff, reject it, I might sort of look at it and say, maybe I should reconsider, or maybe it's not doing what I want it to do.
Excellent.
You know, rejection just means it wasn't right for their magazine. There's a million reasons it could not be right. They could have bought a story kind of like it, you know, a couple weeks ago. Well, I already have a first-person little magic shop story. I'm not going to buy another one. I mean, there's so many reasons that if you think it's good, then, yeah, stand by the work. Send it out.
Bam.
Cool. Cool. Very good. Well, I appreciate that. That's, my kids will enjoy this, I think. So.
Yeah, and we appreciate it too. We are the clock has expired once again. We're gonna need to get out the defibrillator and resurrect it, because it has died, as it always does. Thankfully, on our 20 minutes with segments. Tim Pratt, thank you, sir, so much for not only making the time, but for sharing a few epiphanies for Brian and I, and also yes. with Brian's class. We Brian has been a long admirer of yours, and through him, I have found that his admiration is not unfounded. So we're very grateful, and we appreciate you sharing your insights with us and our listeners.
Thanks so much, guys. It was a real pleasure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Brian? Closing yes. thoughts, man. This had to have been an awesome episode for you.
Oh my, this was a real treat for me, and I just appreciate you taking the time to come on and do this with us. So I'm glowing for the rest of the day.
he's like a little cloud floating around. That's awesome. And as long as we're sending out gratitude to you, dear listeners, for hitting that play button. As always, you are the reason why we do this. Thank you so much. Thank you for your comments on the posts. Those have been fabulous. Your reviews on iTunes are always appreciated for those that have done that. Thank you so much. Just a general outpouring of gratitude is where we're at right now. And here's something to look forward to. In just a few short days, we are going to have Master Pratt back, and we are going to workshop a story with Tim and our guest writer, and I can only assume that it is going to be a veritable cornucopia overflowing with fabulosity and gloriousness.
Most definitely.
So definitely come back for that. In the meantime, I'm going to say, friends, you find what you're looking for, so look for amazing stuff. You will find it. Brian, any suggestions for what they're doing while they're looking for amazing stuff?
Sure, yeah. Don't worry about what you do before writing to get into the zone. Just go write.
Just go write. Excellent. Excellent. Friends, we will see you in just a few short days. Until then, stay frosty, and we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBroyer, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is at writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.